able to decide whether to faint or to run out of the room shrieking, I'd simply stood frozen until John had nudged me gently, whispering in my ear, and I'd blurted out, "I do," and collapsed on the ottoman, flowers spilling from my hands. Caught up in the memory, I'd missed what William was saying and shook my head, trying to focus. "I've been searching for him for the last 3 months," he said, putting down his cup and wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. "He's an elusive scoundrel, and I don't know that he's in Savannah at all, for that matter. But the last hint I had of him was in Charleston, and he left there 3 weeks ago, heading south. Now, for all I know, the fellow's bound for Florida, or has already taken ship for England. On the other hand, Amaranthus is here, or at least I believe so. Richardson seems to take an inordinate interest in the Gray family and its connections, so perhaps... Do you know Dennis Randall yourself, by the way?" He was looking at me intently over his cup, and I realized, with a faint sense of amusement mingled with outrage, that he'd thrown the name at me suddenly in hopes of surprising any guilty knowledge I might have. "Why, you little scallywag," I thought, amusement getting the upper hand. "You need a bit more practice before you can pull off that sort of thing, my lad." I did, in fact, know something about Dennis Randall that William almost certainly didn't know, and that Dennis Randall himself might not know. But it wasn't information that would shed any light on the whereabouts and motives of Ezekiel Richardson. "I've never met him," I said, quite truthfully, and held up my cup toward the serving maid for more cider. "I used to know his mother, Mary Hawkins. We met in Paris. A lovely, sweet girl. But I've had no contact with her for the last 34 years. I assume from what you tell me that she married a Mr. Isaacs. You said he was a Jewish merchant?"
"Yes, so Randall said. And I can't see why he'd lie about it."
"Nor can I. But what you do know, you think," I corrected, "is that while Dennis Randall and Ezekiel Richardson have heretofore appeared to be working together, now they aren't." William shrugged, impatient.
"So far as I know, I haven't seen Randall since he warned me about Richardson. But I haven't seen Richardson either."
I could sense his rising desire to be up and off. He was drumming his fingers softly on the tabletop, and the table itself shuddered slightly when his leg bumped it. "Where are you staying, William?" I asked impulsively before he could go. In case I do see Richardson. Or hear anything of Amaranthus, for that matter. I am a doctor. A lot of people come to see me, and everyone talks to a doctor." He hesitated, but then gave another shrug, this one infinitesimal. "I've taken a room at Hendry's, on River Street." He stood, tossed some money on the table, and extended a hand to help me up. "We're staying at Landrum's, one square over from the city market," I said on impulse, rising. "If you should want to call, or need help. Just in case, I mean." His face had gone carefully blank, though his eyes were burning like match flames. I felt a chill, knowing from experience the sort of thing that was likely going on behind such a facade.
"I doubt it, Mrs. Fraser," he said politely.
And kissing my hand in brief farewell, he left. Chapter 128. Gigging Frogs. December the 22nd, 1778. Jamie took a firm grip of the back of Germaine's shirt and beckoned with his free hand to Ian, who held the torch.
"Look out over the water first, aye?"
Jamie whispered, lifting his chin at the black glitter of the submerged marsh. It was broken by clumps of waist-high cordgrass and smaller ones of needle rush, bright green in the torchlight. This was a deep spot, though, with two or three of what the natives of Savannah called hammocks, though plainly they meant hummock. Wee islands, with trees like wax myrtle and yorpen holly bushes, though these too were of a spiky nature. Like everything else in a marsh, save the frogs and fish. Some of the spikier inhabitants of the marsh, though, were mobile, and nothing you wanted to meet unexpectedly. Germaine peered obediently into the darkness, his gigging spear held tight and high, poised for movement. Jamie could feel him tremble, partly from the chill, but mostly, he thought, from excitement. A sudden movement broke the surface of the water, and Germaine lunged forward, plunging his gig into the water with a high-pitched yell. Fergus and Jamie let out much deeper cries, each grabbing Germaine by an arm and hauling him backward over the mud, as the irate cottonmouth he'd nearly speared turned on him, lashing, yawning mouth flaring white. But the snake, luckily, had business elsewhere, and swam off with a peeved sinuosity. Ian, safely out of range, was laughing.
"Think it's funny, do you?" said Germaine, scowling in order to pretend he wasn't shaking.
"Aye, I do," his uncle assured him. "Be even funnier if you were eaten by an alligator, though. See there?"
He lifted the torch and pointed. 10 feet away there was a ripple in the water between them and the nearest hammock. Germaine frowned uncertainly at it, then turned his head to his grandfather.
"That's an alligator. How'd you ken that?"
"It is,"
Jamie said. His own heart was pounding from the sight of the cottonmouth. Snakes unnerved him, but he wasn't scared of alligators.
"Cautious, yes. Scared, no. See how the ripples come back from the island there?"
"Aye,"
Germaine squinted across the water.
"So?"
"Those ripples are coming toward us side on. The one Ian's pointing at, it's coming at a right angle, right toward us."
It was, though slowly.
"Are alligators good to eat?"
Fergus asked, watching it thoughtfully.
"A good deal more meat on one than on a frog, Nespa." "They are, and there is, aye."
Ian shifted his weight a little, gauging the distance.
"We cannot kill one of those with spears, though. I should have brought my bow."
"Should we move?"
Germaine asked doubtfully.
"Nay, see how big it is first,"
Ian said, fingering the long knife at his belt. He was wearing a breech clout, and his bare legs were long and steady as a heron's, standing mid-calf in the muddy water. The four of them watched with great concentration as the ripple came on, paused, came on a little more. Slowly.
"Are they stunned by light, Ian?"
Jamie asked, low-voiced.
"Frogs were,
and they had maybe 2 dozen bullfrogs in their sack, surprised in the water and killed before they kent what hit them."
"I didn't think so,"
Ian whispered back.
"I've not hunted one before, though."
There was a sudden gleam in the water, a scatter of ripples, and the glow of 2 small burning orbs, a demon's eyes.
"I hear,"
Jamie said, making a convulsive sign against evil. Fergus pulled Germaine back farther, making a clumsy sign of the cross with his hook. Even Ian seemed taken aback a bit. His hand fell from his knife, and he stepped back toward the mud, not taking his eyes off the thing.
"It's a wee one, I think,"
he said, reaching safety.
"See, its eyes are named bigger than my thumbnail." "Does that matter if it's possessed?"
Fergus asked, suspicious.
"Even if we were to kill it, we might be poisoned." "Oh, I don't think so,"
Jamie said. He could see it now as it hung motionless in the water, stubby, clawed feet halfway drawn up. It was perhaps 2 feet long, the toothy jaw maybe 6 inches. It could give you a nasty bite, nay more, but it wasn't close enough to reach.
"Ken what a wolf's eyes look like in the dark. Or a possum's."
He'd taken Fergus hunting, of course, when he was young, but seldom at night. And such things as you'd hunt at night in the Highlands were usually running from you, not looking at you. Ian nodded, not taking his eyes off the small reptile.
"Aye, that's true. Wolves' eyes are usually green or yellow, but I've seen them red like that sometimes, by torchlight. I would suppose that a wolf could be possessed by an evil spirit as easily as an alligator could,"
Fergus said, a little testily. It was clear, though, that he wasn't afraid of the thing either, now that he'd got a good look. They were all beginning to relax.
"He thinks we're stealing his frogs,"
Germaine said, giggling. He was still holding the spear, and even as he spoke, he spotted something and slammed the three-tined sapling into the water with a whoop.
"I got it! I got it!" he shouted,
and splashed into the water, heedless of the alligator. He bent to see that his prey was firmly transfixed, let out another small whoop, and pulled up his spear, displaying a catfish of no mean size, belly showing white in its frantic flapping, blood running in trickles from the holes made by the tines.
"More meat on that than on yon wee lizard there, aye?"
Ian took the spear, pulled the fish off, and bashed its head with the hilt of his knife to kill it.
Everyone looked, but the alligator had departed, alarmed by the kerfuffle. "Aye, that's us fettled, I think."
Jamie picked up both bags, one half full of bullfrogs, and the other still squirming slightly from the inclusion of a number of shrimp and crayfish netted from the shallows. He held open the one with the frogs for Ian to toss the fish inside, saying a verse from the hunting blessing for Germaine.
"Thou shalt not eat fallen fish, nor fallen flesh, nor one bird that thy hand shall not bring down. Be thou thankful for the one, though nine should be swimming."
Germaine was not paying attention, though. He was standing quite still, fair hair lifting in the breeze, his head turned.
"Le grand-père,"
he said, voice urgent.
"Look!"
They all looked, and saw the ships, far out beyond the marsh, but coming in, heading for the small headland to the south. 7, 8, 9, a dozen at least, with red lanterns at their masts, blue ones at the stern. Jamie felt the hair rise on his body, and his blood go cold.
"British men of war,"
Fergus said, his voice empty with shock.
"They are,"
Jamie said.
"We'd best get home."
It was almost dawn before I felt Jamie slide into bed behind me, bringing chilled skin and the smell of brine, cold mud and marsh plants with him. Also,
"What's that smell?"
I asked drowsily, kissing the arm he'd put round me.
"Frogs, I expect. God, you're warm, Sassenach."
He cuddled closer, pressing his body into mine, and I felt him pull loose the bow of the ribbon that gathered the neck of my shift.
"Good hunting, then."
I obligingly wriggled my bottom into the hollow of his thighs, and he sighed in appreciation, his breath warm on my ear, and slipped a cold hand inside my shift.
"Ooh!" "Aye, Germaine caught a fine big catfish, and we brought back a sack of crawfish and shrimp, the wee grey ones."
"Mmm, we'll have a good supper, then."
His temperature was quickly equalizing with mine, and I was drifting pleasantly back down towards sleep, though quite willing to be roused for the right reasons.
"We saw a wee alligator, and a snake, a water moccasin."
"You didn't catch those, I hope."
I knew that snakes and alligators were technically edible, but I didn't think we were quite hungry enough to make the challenges of cooking one worthwhile.
"No." "Oh, and a dozen British ships full of soldiers turned up too."
"That's lie."
"What?"
I flipped over in his arms, ending face to face.
"British soldiers," he repeated gently. "Then a farce, Sassenach. I expect it will be all right. Fergus and I already hid the press, and we haven't got any silver to bury. That's one thing to be said for poverty,"
he added reflectively, stroking my bottom.
"You dinna need to fear being plundered."
"That... what the bloody hell are they doing here?" I rolled over and sat straight up in bed, pulling my shift up round my shoulders.
"Well, you did say Pardlow told you they meant to cut off the southern colonies, aye? I imagine they decided to start here."
"Why here? Why not Charleston or Norfolk?"
"Well, I couldn't see, not being privy to the British councils of war," he said mildly. "But if I was to guess, I'd say it's maybe that there are a good many troops already in Florida, and they'll be marching up to join this new lot. The Loyalists are thick as fleas on a dog all along the coast of the Carolinas.
If the armies secured Florida and Georgia, they'd be well placed to advance northward, picking up local support.
You have it all figured out, I see. I pressed my back against the wall. There was no headboard, and finished retying the ribbon of my shift. I didn't feel equal to meeting an invasion with my bosom uncovered.
No, he admitted, but there are only two things to do, Sassenach. Stay or flee. It's the dead of winter in the mountains. We cannot get through the passes till March, and I'd rather not be stravaguing about the countryside with three bairns, two pregnant women, and nae money. And I doubt they'll burn the city, not if they mean it to be a base for invading the rest of the south.
He reached up and ran a soothing hand down my shoulder and arm.
It's not as though you've not lived in an occupied city before.
I said dubiously, but he did have a point. There were some advantages to the situation, the chief one being that if an army already held a city, they wouldn't be attacking it. No fighting in the streets. But then, he didn't hold it yet.
Dinna fash yourself, lass,
he said softly, and twined a finger in my ribbon.
Did I not tell you when we wed, you'd have the protection of my body?
You did, I admitted, and laid a hand over his. It was big, strong, and capable.
Then come lie with me, Mooney and Dunn, and let me prove it, he said,
and pulled the ribbon loose. Frog legs of that size really did look quite like chicken drumsticks. And tasted very like, too, dredged in flour and egg with a little salt and pepper, and fried. Why is it that the meat of strange animals is so often described as tasting like chicken? Rachel asked, neatly snaring another leg out from under her husband's reaching hand. I've heard people say that of everything, from catamount to alligator.
Because it does,
Ian answered, raising a brow at her and stabbing his fork into a platter of catfish chunks, similarly coated and fried. Well, if you want to be technical about it, I began, to a chorus of mingled groans and laughter. Before I could launch into an explanation of the biochemistry of muscle fibre, though, there was a rap on the door. We'd been making so much noise over supper that I hadn't heard footsteps on the stair and was taken by surprise. Germaine popped up to open the door, and gazed up in surprise at two Continental officers in full uniform. There was a general scraping of chairs as the men stood up, and Jamie stepped out from behind the table. He'd been working in the warehouse all day after hunting in the marshes half the night, and was not only barefoot, but wearing a badly stained, grimy shirt and a faded plaid, so worn that it was thin in spots. Still, no one would have doubted that he was the master of the house. When he inclined his head and said,
"Gentlemen, be welcome."
Both officers took off their hats, bowed, and came in, murmuring,
"Your servant, sir."
"General Fraser," the senior officer said,
the title not quite a question as he eyed Jamie's attire.
"I am Major General Robert Howe."
I'd never seen Major General Howe before, but I knew his companion, and my hand tightened on the bread knife. He was wearing a colonel's uniform now, and his face was as blandly forgettable as ever. But I wasn't likely to forget Captain Ezekiel Richardson, lately a captain in His Majesty's Army, last seen in Clinton's headquarters in Philadelphia.
"Your humble servant, sir,"
Jamie said, in a tone quite belying the usual compliment.
"I am James Fraser, but no longer an officer in the army. I have resigned my commission." "So I understand, sir."
Howe's rather bulging eyes scanned the table, flicking past Jenny, Rachel, Masali, and the little girls before settling on me. He gave a small nod of inward conviction and bowed to me.
"Mrs. Fraser, I trust I see you well, ma'am."
Obviously, he'd heard the story behind Jamie's dramatic resignation.
"You do, thank you," I said.
"Do watch out for the crayfish there, Colonel." For Richardson was standing just in front of the tin tub in which I'd set the crayfish, covered with water, and supplied with a few handfuls of cornmeal with which they'd purge their nasty little entrails over the next 24 hours and become safe to eat.
"Your pardon, ma'am,"
he said politely, moving aside. Unlike Howe, he was chiefly concerned with the men. I saw his eyes touch for an instant on Fergus's hook, dismiss him, then rest on Ian with an air of satisfaction. What Jamie called a cold grue went down my back. I knew already what they wanted. This was a high-level press gang. Jamie recognized their purpose, too.
"My wife is well, thanks be to God, General. I expect she would like her husband to remain in that condition, too."
Well, that was fairly blunt. Howe evidently decided there was no point in further civilities and waded in directly.
"Are you aware, sir, that a number of British troops have disembarked just outside the city and doubtless mean to invade and capture it?"
"I am,"
Jamie said patiently.
"I watched their ships come in last night. As for capturing the city, I think they're very well placed to do just that. And if I were you, General, and I thank the Lord that I'm not, I should be gathering my men this minute and marching out of the city with them. Ken the proverb about living to fight another day, do you? I recommend it as a strategy."
"Do I understand you aright, sir?"
Richardson put in, his tone edgy.
"You decline to join in the defence of your own city?"
"Aye, we do,"
Ian put in before Jamie could answer. He eyed the visitors in an unfriendly way, and I saw his right hand drop to his side, reaching for Rollo's head. Then his fingers curl up tight, missing it.
"It's no our city, and we're no disposed to die for it."
I was sitting next to Rachel and felt her shoulders lose a little of their tension. Across the table, Marsali's eyes slid sideways, meeting Fergus's, and I saw a moment of silent marital communication and accord.
"If they don't know who we are, don't tell them."
Howe, a rather thick-set man, opened and closed his mouth several times before finding words.
"I am appalled, sir,"
he managed finally, his face quite red.
"Appalled,"
he repeated, his second chin quivering with outrage, and I thought, no little desperation,
"that a man known for his bravery in battle, his constancy to the cause of freedom, would cravenly submit to the rule of the bloody tyrant."
"A choice little short of treason," Richardson put in, nodding severely.
I raised my eyebrows at this and stared at him, but he sedulously avoided my eye. Jamie stood looking at them for a moment, rubbing a forefinger down the bridge of his nose.
"Mr. Howe,"
he said at last, dropping his hand.
"How many men have you in your command?"
"Why, nearly 1,000.
"How nearly?"
600, Richardson said, at the same moment that Howe exclaimed,
900, sir."
"Aye,"
said Jamie, clearly unimpressed.
"Those transports carry 3,000 men easily, well armed, with artillery. And they've an entire Highland regiment with them, too. I heard their pipes as they came ashore."
Howe's colour faded noticeably.
Still, he had grit. He kept his dignity.
"Whatever the odds, sir," he said, "it is my duty to fight and to protect the city entrusted to my care."
"I respect your devotion to your duty, General," Jamie said quite seriously. "And may God be with you. But I won't."
"We could physically compel you," Richardson pointed out.
"You could,"
Jamie agreed, unruffled.
"But to what end? You cannot make me command men if I refuse to do it. And what good is an unwilling soldier?"
"This is craven cowardice, sir,"
Howe said. But it was clear that this was bluster, and poorly acted bluster at that.
"God between us and evil,"
Jamie said quietly, and nodded toward the door.
"Go with God, gentlemen, but leave my house."
"Thee did well, Jamie," Rachel said quietly, after the sound of the soldier's footsteps had faded from the stairwell. "No friend could have spoken more wisely." He glanced at her, mouth quirking.
"Thank you, lass," he said. "But I think you can. I wasn't speaking from the same reasons a friend might."
"Oh, I do," she said, smiling. "But the effect is the same. And friends are grateful for whatever they can get. Will they have the last frog leg?"
A small ripple of laughter ran through the adults, and the children, who had been sitting rigid and white-faced during the soldier's visit, relaxed as though they were balloons that someone had let the air out of, and began zooming around the room in relief. Fearing for the tub of crayfish, Jenny and Masali marshalled them into some sort of order and marched them off home to bed. Masali pausing to kiss Fergus and adjuring him to be careful walking home alone.
"The British are not in the city yet, mon chou," he said, kissing her back.
"Aye, well, it never hurts to keep in practice," she said tartly. "Come along, you wee rattens."
The rest of us sat for a time, discussing the immediate future and what little might be done. Jamie was right about the advantages of poverty in such a situation, but at the same time... "They'll take whatever food they find," I said, "at least at first." I gave the shelf behind me a quick glance. It was our pantry, and held the sum total of the household stores. A small crock of lard, cloth bags of oatmeal, flour, rice, beans, and parched corn, a braid of onions, and a few dried apples, half a wheel of cheese, a little box of salt and a pepper pot, and the remains of a loaf of sugar, plus our small stock of candles.
"Aye."
Jamie nodded, got up, and fetched his purse, which he turned out on the table.
14 shillings, about. Ian, Fergus."
Ian and Rachel's resources amounted to another 9 shillings. Fergus's, 1 guinea, 2 shillings, and a handful of pennies.
"See what you can get at the tavern tomorrow, lass," he said, pushing a small pile of coins toward Rachel. "I think I can put aside a cask of salt fish from the warehouse. And you, Sasnach, if you're quick at the market in the morning, you might manage to get more rice and beans, maybe a flitch of bacon."
Bits of copper and silver winked on the table before me, the king's stolid countenance chiselled in profile.
"There's no good hiding place in our room," Ian observed, looking around. "Nor here. Auntie's wee surgery, do you think?" "Aye, that's what I was thinking. It's a board floor, and the building's got a good foundation. I'll maybe make a wee hidey hole tomorrow. I shouldn't think there's much in your surgery that soldiers would want."
This last was said questioningly to me.
"Only the medicines that are made with alcohol," I said.
I took a deep breath. "Speaking of soldiers, I have to tell you something. It may not be important, but then again..." And I told them about Ezekiel Richardson.
"You're quite sure of it, Sasanach?"
Jamie frowned a little, red brows sparking in the candlelight.
"Your man's got a face that might belong to anyone."
"He's not what you'd call memorable at all," I admitted. "But yes, I am sure. He has that mole on the side of his chin. I remember that. It's more the way he was looking at me, though. He recognized me, I'm positive."
Jamie drew breath and blew it out slowly, considering. Then he put his hands flat on the table and looked at Ian.
"Your auntie met my son William in the city the other day." "By accident," he said, his voice carefully neutral. "Tell them what he said of Richardson, Sasnach, will you?"
I did, keeping an eye on the pulse in Ian's throat. So was Rachel. She put a hand quietly on his, which he was clenching in a fist on the table. He glanced at her, smiled briefly, and reluctantly unclenched it, lacing his fingers with hers.
"And what's William doing here, then?"
Ian asked, obviously working to keep any hint of hostility out of his voice.
"He was looking for Richardson, in fact, but he's also searching for his cousin's wife, a woman named Amaranthus Grey, or perhaps Cowden, I added. She might be going by her maiden name. I'd meant to ask if either of you had heard any mention of her. Both Ian and Rachel shook their heads. He would remember a name like that, Rachel said. But he thinks William doesn't know that Richardson is here?
I'm sure he doesn't, I said.
Nor that Richardson has gone over to the rebels, apparently. There was silence for a moment. I could hear the faint clicking of the crayfish in the tub behind me, and the slight pop as a fault in the candlewick made the flame bob and dance.
This man Richardson may simply have changed his allegiance, Rachel suggested. I know of many who have, over the last 2 years.
He might, I said slowly. But the thing is, John thought he was an intelligencer, a spy or secret agent of some sort. And when someone of that stripe turns his coat, you have to ask whether he's turned it once or twice, or not at all, don't you?
Jamie laid a hand on the table, thinking,
I will, he said at last,
and sitting up straight, stretched himself with a sigh.
If there's aught fishy about the man, we'll ken it soon enough.
We will? I asked. He gave me a wry smile.
Aye, Sassenach. He'll come looking for you. Keep your wee knife close to hand, aye?
Chapter 129 Invasion December the 29th We heard the guns soon after dawn. Jamie paused in the act of shaving to listen. It was a distant thunder, irregular, muffled by distance. But I had heard artillery close at hand, and felt the sound as an echo in my bones, urging instant flight. Jamie had heard artillery at a much closer range than I, and set down his razor, planting his hands flat on the washstand. To keep them from trembling, I thought.
They're firing cannon from the ships in the river, he said quietly, and regular artillery from the south. God help Howe and his men.
He crossed himself and picked up the razor.
How far away do you think they are?
I had paused in the act of putting on my stockings, and now drew one up, slowly fastening my garter. Jamie shook his head.
No telling from in here. I'll go out in a bit, though, and then I'll see how the wind lies.
You're going out? I asked, uneasy at the prospect. Surely you're not going to work today?
Fadler's warehouse, where he worked as a supervisor and senior clerk, was on the river.
I am not, he said briefly, but I thought I'd go and fetch the bairns and my Sally and my sister. Fergus will be gone to see what's happening, and I dinna want them left alone without a man.
His mouth thinned.
Especially not if the soldiers come into the city.
I nodded, at once unable to speak. The thought of the things that happened could happen during an invasion. I had, thank God, never lived through such an event, but had seen too many newsreels and photographs to be under any illusions as to the possibilities. And there had already been reports of a British company come up from Florida under an officer named Major Prevost, raiding the countryside around Sunbury, running off cattle and burning barns and farmhouses. Sunbury was not nearly far enough away for comfort. When Jamie left, I rattled around for a few minutes and decided what to do first, but then pulled myself together and decided to make a quick visit to my surgery. It would be a good idea to take away my more valuable instruments. Not that any of them had great value. There was no black market in amputation saws, at least not yet, and such drugs and supplies as might be needed if... I'd cut that if off sharply and looked around our modest room. I had been keeping only a few staples, like flour and butter, and the more perishable items of food here. Anything that could be stored for a while was now hidden under the floor of my surgery. If we were about to have Masali, Jenny, and the children to stay for an indefinite time, though, I'd best bring back a few more things. I took my biggest basket and knocked at Rachel's door downstairs. She answered at once, already dressed to go out. "Ian has gone with Fergus," she said, before I could ask. "He says he will not fight with the militia, but that Fergus is his brother, and it is his duty to see him safe." "I can't complain about that."
"I could," I said frankly. "I'd complain like Billy-o if I thought it would do any good.
Waste of breath, though. Will you come with me down to the surgery? Jamie's gone to get Jenny and Masali and the children, so I thought I'd best bring back something for them to eat." "Let me get my basket."
The streets were full of people, most of them in some process of leaving the city, fetching goods or drawing carts through the streets, though some were clearly bent on looting. I saw two men break a window and crawl through it into a large house off Ellis Square. We reached the surgery without incident, though, and found two whores standing outside. They were women I knew, and I introduced them to Rachel, who was much less discomposed by the introduction than they were. "We're wanting to buy pox cures, missus," said Molly, a sturdy Irish girl. "So many as you might have to hand, and be willing to part with."
"Are you, expecting, a rash of the pox, so to speak?"
I was unlocking the door as we spoke, calculating whether the current crop of penicillin was likely to be sufficiently potent as to make any difference.
"It don't matter that much whether it works or not, ma'am," said Iris, who was very tall, very thin, and very black. "We uns planned to sell 'em to the soldiers."
"I see," I said, rather blankly. "Well, then."
I gave them what penicillin I had in liquid form, declining to charge them. I kept the powdered mould and the remnants of Rockford cheese, though, in case the family might have need of them, and suffered a bolt of vivid fear at the thought of Fergus and Ian doing God knew what. The artillery had stopped, or the wind had changed, but it started up again as we made our way home, holding our baskets under our cloaks to prevent snatch-and-grab attacks. Jamie had brought back Masali and Jenny and the children, all of them carrying what they could in the way of clothes, food and bedding. There was a long period of total chaos while things were organised. But at last we sat down to a sort of rough tea at around 3 o'clock. Jamie, declining to be involved in the domestic engineering, had exercised his male prerogative of disappearing on vaguely unspecified business. But with unerring instinct, reappeared just as the cake was being set out, bearing a large gunny sack full of clams, a barrel of flour, and a modicum of news.
"The fighting's over," he said, looking for some place to set the clams down.
"I noticed the guns had stopped some time ago. Do you know what's happened?" I took the bag and decanted the clams with a loud clatter into the empty cauldron, then poured a bucket of water over them. They'd keep until supper.
"Exactly what I told General Howe would happen," he said, though not with any sense of pleasure at being right. "Campbell. That's the British Lieutenant Colonel Archibald Campbell. Circled Howe and his men and bagged them up like fish in a net. I don't ken what he's done with him, but I expect there will be troops in the city before nightfall."
The women all looked at one another and relaxed visibly. This was actually good news. What with one thing and another, the British Army was quite good at occupying cities. And while the citizenry might justifiably resent the billeting of troops and the requisitioning of supplies, the underlying fact was that there's nothing for keeping public order like having an army living with you.
"Will we be safe, then, with the soldiers here?" Joni asked.
She was bright-eyed with the adventure, like her siblings, and had been following the adult conversation closely.
"Aye, mostly," Jamie said.
But his eye met Masali's and she grimaced. "We probably would be safe enough, though food might be short for a while, until the army quartermasters got things straightened out. Fergus and Bonnie, though, were another matter."
"Luckily we hadn't started up Longyon yet," she said, answering Jamie's look. "It's only been printing up handbills and broadsheets and the odd religious tract." "I think it will be all right," she said bravely, but she reached to touch Félicité's dark head, as though to reassure herself.
We had the clams made into chowder. Rather a watery chowder, as we had very little milk. But we thickened it with crumbled biscuit, and there was enough butter, and was setting the table for supper when Fergus and Ian came clattering up the stairs, flushed with excitement and full of news.
"It was a black slave who made the difference," Fergus said, cramming a piece of bread into his mouth. "Mon Dieu, I'm famished. We haven't eaten all day. This man wandered into the British camp soon after the fighting began and offered to show them a secret path through the swamp. Lieutenant Colonel Campbell sent a regiment of islanders. We could hear the pipes. It reminded me of Prestonpans."
He grinned at Jamie, and I could see the scrawny 10-year-old French orphan he'd been, riding on a captured cannon. He swallowed and washed the bite down with water, that being all we had at the moment.
"Highlanders," he continued, "and some other infantry. And they followed the slave through the swamp and got well round General Howe's men, who were all clumped together. For, of course, they didn't know from which direction the fight might come."
Campbell had then sent another infantry company to Howe's left.
"To make some demonstrations," Fergus said, waving an airy hand and scattering crumbs. "They turned, of course, to meet this, and then the islanders fell on them from the other side, and voila!"
He snapped his fingers.
"I doubt Howe feels any gratitude to that slave," Ian put in, scooping his bowl into the cauldron of chowder. "But he ought. He didn't lose more than 30 or 40 men, and had they stood and fought, they'd likely all have been killed, if they hadn't had the sense to surrender. And he didn't strike me as a man of sense," he added thoughtfully. "How long do you think they'll stay, the army?"
Jenny was slicing bread and handing out the pieces round the table, but paused to wipe a forearm across her brow. It was winter, but with the fire going in the small room, and so many people crowded in, the temperature was quickly approaching Turkish bath levels. All the men exchanged glances. Then Jamie spoke, reluctantly.
"A long time, Apure."
Chapter 130. A Sovereign Cure. It had to be done, and it had to be done now. Between Jamie's uneasiness and my own misgivings, I'd put off the question of making ether. But now we were up against it. I simply couldn't do what needed to be done for Sophronia without a dependable general anaesthetic. I'd already decided that I could do the manufacture in the tiny tool shed in Mrs. Landrum's huge kitchen garden. It was outside the city limits, with an acre of open space on every side, this occupied only by winter kale and hibernating carrots. If I blew myself to kingdom come, I wouldn't take anyone else with me. I doubted that this observation would reassure Jamie to any great extent, though, so I put off mentioning my plans. I'd assemble what I needed and tell him only at the last minute, thus saving him worry. And after all, if I couldn't obtain the necessary ingredients. But I was sure that I could. Savannah was a sizable city and a shipping port. There were at least 3 apothecaries in town, as well as several warehouses that imported specialty items from England. Someone was bound to have sulfuric acid, otherwise known as oil of vitriol. The weather was cool but sunny, and seeing a number of red-coated soldiers in the street, I wondered idly whether climatic considerations had had anything to do with the British deciding to switch their theatre of operations to the south. The elder Mr. Jameson, a sprightly gentleman in his 70s, greeted me pleasantly when I entered Jameson's apothecary. I'd had occasion to make small purchases of herbs from him before, and we got on well. I presented him with my list and browsed among the jars on his shelves while he pottered to and fro in search of my requests. There were 3 young soldiers on the other side of the shop, gathered in furtive conversation with the younger Mr. Jameson, over something he was showing them under his counter. Pox cures, I assumed, or, giving them the benefit of the doubt regarding foresight, possibly condoms. They concluded their surreptitious purchases and scuttled out, heads down and rather red in the face. The younger Mr. Jameson, who was the grandson of the owner and about the same age as the just-departed soldiers, was also rather pink, but greeted me with aplomb, bowing.
"Your servant, Mrs. Fraser. Might I be of assistance?"
"Oh, thank you, Nigel," I said. "Your grandfather has my list, but..." A thought had occurred to me, perhaps jogged by the soldiers. "I wonder whether you might know of a Mrs. Gray? Amaranthus Gray is her name, and I believe her maiden name was... Oh, what was it? Cowden. Amaranthus Cowden Gray. Have you ever heard that name?" He wrinkled his very smooth brow in thought.
"What an odd name. Meaning no offence, ma'am," he hastily assured me. "I meant rather exotic. Quite unusual."
"Yes, it is. I don't know her," I said, "but a friend of mine said that she lived in Savannah and had urged me to, make her acquaintance."
"Yes, of course."
Nigel hummed for a bit but shook his head.
"No, I'm sorry, ma'am. I don't believe I've ever encountered an Amaranthus Cowden."
"Cowden?" said Mr. Jameson, emerging suddenly from his back room with several bottles in his hands. "Of course we have, boy. Or rather, not encountered. She's never come in the shop. But we had a request brought by mail only 2 or 3 weeks ago, asking for... Oh, what was it? My mind is a sieve, Mrs. Fraser. An absolute sieve, I assure you. Don't get old, that's my advice. Oh, yes. Gould's complexion cream. Villette's gripe water. A box of pastilles to sweeten the breath. And a dozen bars of Savon d'Artagnan French soap. That was it."
He beamed at me over his spectacles.
"She lives in Saperville," he added, as an afterthought. "You're a wonder, Grandad,"
Nigel murmured dutifully, and reached for the bottles his grandfather was holding.
"Shall I wrap these, or are we mixing something for the lady?"
"Oh."
Mr. Jameson looked down at the bottles in his hands as though wondering how they'd got there.
"Oh, yes. I wanted to ask you, Mrs. Fraser, what it was you had in mind to do with oil of vitriol. It's amazingly dangerous, you know."
Yes, I do." I eyed him consideringly. Some men would be quite capable of refusing to sell a woman something they thought inappropriate or dangerous. But Mr. Jameson seemed of worldly sort. He did at least know that I knew the use of medicinal herbs. "I have it in mind to make ether," I said. The substance was known, I knew. Someone or other had discovered it back in the 8th century, or so I was told in medical school. But its use as an anaesthetic wouldn't be developed till somewhere in the 19th century. I wondered idly whether anyone in the intervening 1100 years had noticed that the stuff put people to sleep, but had inadvertently killed them, and thus abandoned further experimentation. Both Mr. Jameson's looked surprised.
"Ether," said Nigel, openly puzzled. "Why would you make it yourself?"
"Why would I?" "What? Do you mean that you have the stuff already made up?" I asked, astonished. Both of them nodded, pleased to be of service.
"Oh, yes," Mr. Jameson said. "We don't always stock it, of course, but with the, army..."
He waved a hand encompassing the recent invasion and occupation.
"There are the troop transports, and there will be a great increase of shipping now that the blockade is not in effect."
"What does the increase of shipping have to do with the sale of ether?" I asked, wondering whether Mr. Jameson might just possibly be right about the effects of advancing age on the brain.
"Why, ma'am," said Nigel, "it's a sovereign cure for the seasickness. Did you not know?"
Chapter 131. A Born Gambler. I counted my instruments for the third time, and finding that none of them had escaped since the last count, covered them with a clean linen cloth, and patted it lightly in reassurance. Whether of the scalpels or myself, I wasn't sure. Silk sutures, gut sutures, needles, the finest embroidery needles obtainable in Savannah, pledgets, swabs, dressings, rolled bandages, a 6-inch willow twig carefully cleaned of its pith, sanded smooth, and boiled slowly, so as not to crack the wood, to be used as a catheter, to stabilize the urethra and bladder, and keep urine out of the surgical field. I'd thought of using a larger one for the bowel, but decided that I'd be better using my fingers to manipulate the slippery tissues there, so long as I managed neither to cut nor puncture myself in the process. Rachel was coming to assist with the surgery, and I'd go through all the instruments and procedures again with her. I'd come down an hour early, though, wanting both to make my final preparations and to spend a little time alone, settling my mind and spirit to the job ahead. I felt surprisingly calm, considering the complexity and risks of the operation ahead. It could be argued that even if I failed, the poor child couldn't possibly be worse off than she was. But of course, she could die as a result of the surgery, from shock, infection, or even accidental hemorrhage. Abdominal surgery was much more serious than trying a transvaginal correction. But given what I had at hand, I thought the chances of achieving a cure were much better that way. And then there was the matter of the curettage that had removed the dead infant. I had no idea what kind of damage that might have inflicted, but if there was any, I might be able to correct it. I glanced automatically at the shelf where my penicillin factory was working. Or at least I hoped it was working. Billions of little spores excreting their helpful substance. I hadn't had time in Savannah to establish a good process and test the resultant product. There was, as was so often the case, no guarantee, whatever, that I had usable penicillin in my broth. But I did have a small chunk of very ripe French cheese, acquired at extravagant cost, and stirred into a little boiled milk to make a paste. The thick scent of it fought for ascendancy with the pungent smell of ether. I could hear the early morning sounds of the city outside, soothing in their ordinariness. The whisk of a broom on a pavement, the clop of horse-drawn wagons, a tantalizing smell of hot bread as the baker's boy's quick footsteps passed by. The simple demands of life quickly made routine out of any sort of chaos, and as invasions went, the occupation of Savannah had been reasonably bloodless. My sense of well-being and calm detachment was interrupted a moment later by the opening of the surgery door. "May I help?" I began, turning. Then I saw my visitor and altered my remark to a fairly hostile, "What do you want?" "Captain?" No, he was a colonel now. The wages of treason, I supposed. Richardson smiled charmingly at me, then turned and bolted the door. I pulled out a drawer and removed my small amputation saw. It was small enough to handle quickly, and the serrated edge would take his nose off, if my aim was good. A charming smile broadened into a grin as he saw what I was about, and he bowed. He wasn't wearing a uniform, and no wonder, but was clothed in a decent, rather sober suit with unpowdered hair tied simply back. No one would have looked at him twice.
"Your most humble servant, ma'am. Have no alarm. I merely wished to make sure we weren't interrupted."
"Yes, that's what I'm alarmed about," I said, taking a firm grip on the saw. "Unbolt that bloody door this minute." He looked at me for a moment, one eye narrowed in calculation, but then uttered a short laugh and, turning, pulled the bolt. Folding his arms, he leaned against the door.
"Better?"
"Much." I let go the saw but didn't move my hand far from it. "I repeat, what do you want?"
"Well, I thought perhaps the time had come to lay my cards upon your table, Mrs. Fraser, and see whether you might want to play a hand or two."
"The only thing I might be inclined to play with you, Colonel, is Mumbletypeg," I said, tapping my fingers on the handle of the saw. "But if you want to show me your cards, go right ahead. You want to be quick about it, though,
I have an operation to conduct in less than an hour.
It shouldn't take that long. May I?
Raising his brows, he gestured at one of the stools. I nodded, and he sat down, looking quite relaxed.
The essence of the matter, ma'am, is that I am a rebel, and always have been.
You... what?
I am presently a colonel in the Continental Army, but when you first knew me, I was working as an American agent in the guise of a captain in His Majesty's Army in Philadelphia.
I don't understand. I grasped what the hell he was telling me, but couldn't grasp why the hell he should be telling me.
You are a rebel yourself, are you not?
One sparse brow lifted in inquiry. He really was the most ordinary-looking man, I thought. If he was a spy, he was physically well-suited for it. I am, I said guardedly.
What about it?
Then we're on the same side, he said patiently.
When I cozened Lord John Grey into marrying you, I...
You what?
Surely he told you that I'd threatened to have you arrested for distributing seditious materials. At which you're very clumsy, I might add, he added dispassionately. His lordship assured me that he had no personal interest in you whatever, and then most obligingly married you the next day. His lordship is a very gallant man, particularly in view of his own preferences.
He cocked his head, smiling in a conspiratorial manner, and a spear of ice shot through my belly.
Oh, you do know, then, he observed, watching my face. I thought you would. He's extremely discreet, but I think you are a very perceptive woman, particularly in sexual matters.
Stand up, I said in my coldest voice, and leave right now. He didn't, of course, and I cursed my lack of forethought in not keeping a loaded pistol in the surgery. The saw might serve if he attacked me, but I knew better than to try attacking him. Besides, what would you do with the body if you killed him? The logical side of my mind inquired. He wouldn't fit in the cupboard, let alone the hidey-hole. For the third and last time, I said, what do you bloody want?
Your help, he said promptly. I'd originally had it in mind to use you as an agent in place. You could have been very valuable to me, moving in the same social circles as the British High Command. But you seem too unstable, forgive me, ma'am, to approach immediately. I hoped that as your grief over your first husband faded, you would come to a state of resignation in which I might seek your acquaintance, and by degrees achieve a state of intimacy in which you could be persuaded to discover small, and at first, seemingly innocent, bits of information, which you would pass on to me.
Just what do you mean by intimacy? I said, folding my arms. Because while the word in current parlance often meant merely friendship, he hadn't used it with that intonation at all.
You're a very desirable woman, Mrs. Fraser, he said, looking me over in an objectionably appraising way. And one who knows her desirability. His lordship obviously wasn't obliging you in that regard, so...
He lifted a shoulder, smiling in a deprecating fashion.
But as General Fraser has returned from the dead, I imagine you're no longer susceptible to lures of that kind.
I laughed and dropped my arms. You flatter yourself, Colonel, I said dryly, if not me.
Look, why not stop trying to fluster me and tell me what you want me to do, and why on earth you think I'd do it?
He laughed too, which lent some sense of individuality to his face.
Very well. It may be difficult to believe, but this war will not be won on the battlefield.
Oh, yes?
Yes, I assure you, ma'am. It will be won by spying and by politics.
A very novel approach, I'm sure. I was trying to place his accent. It was English, but a rather flat sort of accent. Not London. Not the North.
Educated, but not polished.
I assume you weren't soliciting my assistance in the political line.
No, actually, I am,
he said,
"if someone indirectly."
"I suggest you try the direct approach," I said. "My patient will be arriving very shortly." The sounds outside had changed. Apprentices and housemaids were going past in little groups, bound for work or daily marketing. Calls to and fro, the occasional giggle of a flirtation in passing. Richardson nodded in acceptance.
"Are you aware of the Duke of Parlow's opinion of this war?"
I was somewhat taken aback by this.
Foolishly, it hadn't occurred to me that Hal might have one, outside the requirements of his service. But if ever I had met a man guaranteed to have opinions, it was Harold, 2nd Duke of Pardlow. What with one thing and another, I've never exchanged views with the Duke on political matters. Nor with his brother, for that matter.
Ah, well, ladies often take no interest in things outside their own sphere of interest. Though I rather thought you might have a wider appreciation, shall we say?
He looked pointedly from my canvas apron and tray of instruments to the other appointments of my surgery. "What about his politics?" I asked shortly, disregarding his implications.
"His Grace is a strong voice in the House of Lords," Richardson said, playing with a frayed thread on the edge of his cuff. "And while he was at first very much in favour of the war, his opinions of late have been noticeably more moderate. He wrote a public letter to the First Minister in the fall, urging a consideration of reconciliation."
"And?" I hadn't the slightest idea where he was going with this, and was growing impatient.
"Reconciliation is not what we want, ma'am," he said,
and pulling the thread free, flicked it aside.
"Such efforts will only delay the inevitable, and interfere with the commitment of the citizenry that we desperately need. But the fact that His Grace shows this moderation of outlook is useful to me."
"Jolly good," I said. "Get to the point, if you please." He ignored this, and proceeded about his exposition as though he had all the time in the world.
Were he fiercely committed to one extreme or the other, he would be difficult to influence. While I don't know His Grace well, everything I know of him indicates that he values his sense of honour.
He does.
Almost as much as he values his family,
Richardson finished. He looked directly at me, and for the first time I felt a flicker of real fear.
"I have for some time been working to acquire influence, whether direct or otherwise, over such members of the Duke's family as are within my reach, with, say, a son, a nephew, perhaps even his brother in my control. It would then be possible to affect His Grace's public position in whatever way seemed most advantageous to us."
"If you're suggesting what I think you're suggesting, then I suggest you leave my sight this instant," I said, in what I hoped was a tone of calm menace. Though I spoiled whatever effect there might have been by adding, "Besides, I have absolutely no connection with any of Pardlow's family now." He smiled faintly, with no sense of pleasantry at all.
"His nephew William is in the city, ma'am, and you were seen speaking with him 9 days ago. Perhaps you are unaware, though, that both Pardlow and his brother are here as well."
"Here?" My mouth hung open for an instant, and I closed it sharply. "With the army?" He nodded.
"I gather that in spite of your recent marital rearrangement, you remain on good terms with Lord John Grey."
"Sufficiently good that I would do nothing whatever to deliver him into your bloody hands, if that's what you had in mind."
"Nothing so crude, ma'am,"
he assured me, with a brief flash of teeth.